One of the questions that actually came up during our Naked Scientist session last Friday with Dr. Chris Smith was definitely about Shell and the permit that Shell was granted 13 years ago to do seismic testing. Now, the ship has arrived. It is here. It's going to be covering a 6,000 square kilometer of testing, on the ocean, and it's going to be happening. What basically happens there is you're looking at rows of air guns that produce sonic booms, and those give any sort of indication of sound waves to the floor of the ocean. It gives an indication, a 3D image of potential sites where they could be drilling for oil. This has got a major impact. So this is what Dr. Chris had to say about the two questions that came up last week in terms of the exploration of Shell.
The answer is that there are impacts, and not just sonic ones. Researchers know that many aquatic species are very sensitive to shockwaves and sound underwater. Many use sound, especially lower frequency sounds, in order to communicate. The reason geologists like to use sound is that in the same way as when a pregnant woman goes to the hospital and has an ultrasound, and sound waves reflected back off of structures inside her and beamed back to a transducer can be used to build up a picture of the layers inside her, and therefore you can work out the profile of, say, a developing baby or other things. You can do the same thing with the Earth. And in fact, it was a Croatian scientist, Mohorovcicic, who discovered about 100 plus years ago the different layers inside the Earth by using natural vibrations from the Earth, earthquakes, and timing how these waves traveled through the Earth, that he was able to resolve where the different layers start and other layers stop. So in order to find out where there are, for instance, different rock layers or voids underground or porous rocks that may contain hydrocarbons that we might want to recover, geologists can send shockwaves into the bottom of the sea. They will reflect off of the bottom of the sea, but some of them will carry on into the rock and reflect off of other deeper layers. Others will meet an interface between one layer and another, travel along for a while, and then come back up. And by measuring where and how these different waves arrive at different points at different times, you can do what Mohorovicic did in Croatia, using his own back of the envelope calculations to about 10 decimal places. I've seen his notebooks. It was amazing. You can work out what's under the ground. So that's great for geology. It's great for us if we want to recover fossil fuels and so on. But animals that are hit by these waves can be impacted. The best evidence we have, apart from indirect evidence of behavioral change, fewer animals like whales and that kind of thing found in certain areas, is in the diving behavior of deep diving animals. And researchers have done studies where they have tagged animals that dive deep underwater. Seals do this, but also many, many whale species, to go in search of deep living species like squid. And what they have found is that, unlike animals that seem to perform a sort of natural trajectory, if they dive a bit, rest a bit, dive, stay down for a certain period of time and then come up slowly, there are circumstances where these animals seem to very abruptly change their pattern, and they'll surface very, very abruptly from way down. And although in order to get the bends, you normally have to be breathing compressed air, if you are under those sorts of pressures and you surface very, very quickly, even without breathing compressed air, you can get a sort of marine animal equivalent of the bends. And they have found evidence of what are called osteonecrotic lesions, damage to bones, in certain deep diving animals that do appear to be surfacing too quickly because they're giving themselves the bends. So the answer is that anything we do has an impact, both good and bad, that we shouldn't do anything until we've actually worked out what that impact might be on a small scale before we extrapolate it to doing it on a big scale. And we should always be receptive to the possibility that there's something we've missed. And if new data come to light, then we should be willing to change our minds and change our activity in order to remember and recognize the fact that we share the planet with quite a few thousand other species.
That's the answer that we got from Dr. Chris Smith. And if you would love to listen to that podcast, you can only listen to that podcast at thenakedscientist.com. And, you know, the campaign against Shell's plan to bomb the wide coast seabed with seismic sound waves in search of oil and gas is in full swing, with activists and business taking up taking on the petroleum giant. Now, leading Eastern Cape supplier Express Petroleum has debranded its Shell service station, and environmental activists have urged motorists to sort of boycott Shell garages. And we want to shed some light on this morning, so we have called in, and we're going to be asking the founder and strategic lead at the Green Connection to chat to us, Liz McDade. A very good morning to you, Liz, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, and good morning to all your listeners.
Tell us about this particular campaign, because, you know, this has been on the back burner. The permit was granted in 2013, and now all of a sudden Shell is saying, hello, we are here, we're going to be doing what we are supposed to be doing, and, you know, what has been granted to us many years ago.
So this is, I think, where the outrage is coming through. So we at the Green Connection have a campaign called Who Stole Our Oceans? And that is, if any of your listeners were to go onto the Petroleum Agency of South Africa PASA's website, you will see a map, and what you will see is the ocean divided up into a lot of little blocks, which means that people or corporations have been given leasing rights to go and do petroleum exploration in the off the ocean. And many of these things seem to have through outside of a process where society can decide if we want to do that. And what has happened with Shell is there have been other proposals and applications where the people have given out notice and said they're doing basic assessments, environment assessment. What happened with Shell is that they got their permit 2013, 2014, the rules changed, but because they were in 2013, they put it under some transitional rules, which has basically meant that they have simply told everybody, we're starting on the 1st of December. And of course, because of all the reasons that Chris has outlined and a few others, we do not believe this is the right thing. And I think what I would just like is to pull us back is the reason you do seismic testing is because you're looking for oil and gas. From a climate change perspective, we know we've got to move away from oil and gas. So if we are moving away from oil and gas, why would we then start the precursor to the drilling for oil and gas and the damage that and sort of impose that harm if in the end we're not going to be digging out oil and gas because for climate reasons we're transitioning our energy in a different way. So that's a critical point for us. I mean, in 2013 maybe we thought we'd do oil and gas, but in 2021 I don't think so.
Yeah, and especially on the back of the fact that, you know, COP26 has promised about 130 billion rand for us to move away from fossil fuels and to move away specifically from coal-fired stations. What is your organization attempting to do, and what is your organization doing in order to get the government to realize, you know, you gave this permit in 2013, a lot has changed and the world has become a lot more aware of the environment and the ecology and, you know, what's happening around us?
So first thing we tried to do was actually ask Shell, where's this permit? And we got a letter back saying, well, actually, the permit's confidential. So we are going to put in an appeal to government. But we are also supporting the bunch of legal team, which is drawn on expertise both nationally and internationally, who are going to seek an urgent interdict to stop the Amazon Warrior from starting the survey. And then we are also mobilizing, together with other organizations, a public pressure campaign to say let's boycott Shell. And I think I just want to make one comment on that. Boycotting Shell is about sending a message to Shell. It's not about you know, or one should always be cognizant of the people who are locally employed at Shell garages. It's not really, you know, there's nothing they can do.
I was going to ask that particular question because, you know, Shell, basically, you have a franchise, you have a garage which you run, which belongs to a major corporation who is now doing something bad. So where do we put our focus? You know, if we're going to be boycotting Shell garages, there are jobs on the line. There's people's livelihoods on the line. Should we not be turning our attention to Shell head office more than anything else?
Well, I think there's protests happening at Shell head office, but if you look at the role of Shell in the world, it seems that they seem to respond maybe better when it hits their pocket. So as a corporation dedicated to making profits, maybe this is a short message. But what we are saying is that boycotting Shell can actually still mean, you know, giving some contribution to the petrol attendance when you pull in. You just don't buy the petrol. And it's over December holidays rather than long term. But I think the other issue is in the Eastern Cape, what we've seen is Shell garages have debranded and shifted to buy their petrol from someone else because those guys have decided that they also, even though they're businesses and they, exactly as you say, have a Shell petrol station, they have decided they're so disgusted with what's going on that they are taking their own action as a small business.
Yeah.
So I think there's space for people to do, you know, many actions, but all of it is peaceful. All of it is aimed at raising awareness, and I think it comes to the space where we are saying that we need to look at the world a bit differently. There are thousands of people along the coast who depend on the ocean for livelihoods, and their livelihoods are potentially at risk because of the impacts of these seismic surveys, and obviously the oil that we might follow, but just the seismic surveys also have an impact.
Chatting to Liz McDade this morning, the founder and strategic lead at The Green Connection. If you have any comments, you'd like to join the conversation on 0214460567 or on the WhatsApp line on 0725671567. Graham in Milnerton, a very good morning to you and welcome to Cape Talk, Graham.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. There's something that's been bothering me since last week. A gentleman whose name escapes me was interviewed on ENCA, environmental expert, and he mentioned that the permit issued by the government department was issued to a shelf company, and this shelf company sold on this permit to other parties. And Shell is like at the end of a queue of a number of people who have been passed this authority to explore. And therefore, there's a chain of people who have taken money out of the system in the way as well. So it's really all back to greed. And I'd like to know if Liz knows whether there's any link or found out any link between who this first party was who was issued the permit, and I'll listen online.
Liz, there's a question to you from Graham out in the Milnerton area. Liz?
Graham, I don't have at my fingertips, but basically what happened is the permit was issued and then there was an arrangement, and that was the term that I recall is it was farmed out. So you have the permit, then you get yourself a partner. So I think Shell has 50%, has another 50%, and then they farmed it out somehow. So there are a whole lot of different players in that mix. So, Graham, I don't have that answer at my fingertips, but you are correct. It seems to be very complex the way that these things start out. And the other thing is that there is also for example, another application which is having to do some environmental assessment because it's coming through now and they didn't get the rules wrong. What you've got is basically a company that does seismic surveys doing a sort of seismic survey over a few blocks for several people. And then there are other situations where the seismic company does the survey and then sort of does it on spec and then will sell to somebody whatever results they get. So, yeah, it's gets very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it is actually quite not just an easy yes or no answer, but thanks for shedding light on that. Liz McDay chatting to us, founder and strategic lead at the Green Connection. Gary Kukumur is out in Qabeja, and he is a Wildlife and Environmental Society, Algoa Bay branch. Gary, you guys are directly affected by this because you're right there on the coast where this is going to be happening. But you gave a very great explanation as to exactly what's going to happen with these ships and how it actually works, you know, in terms of the sort of rows of air guns that are going to be out there, the sonic booms. Would you give the listeners that explanation so that we have an insight as to exactly how the practical operation is going to play out?
Sure. Morning, and morning to your listeners, and great to hear Liz. Basically, what happens is that it's a sort of three-boat convoy. The main ship is a seismic ship, and they do what they call seismic blasting. But in essence, what that is they trail behind the boat in a rows of air guns. Now, the air gun gives off a sound, and that sound is a sonic boom that bounces off the seabed, penetrates the rock, and then is caught up by hydrophones from the same ship, and that then is translated into a 3D image of the sea bottom and then indicates where rock that is likely to hold oil or gas is located. The problem is that when Shell talks about it, they talk about a single air gun. When you look at the detail of it, is that they've got about three rows of these air guns, and there's about 34 air guns to a row. So that's 108 air guns that are firing simultaneously. And they fire every, I think it's 17 or 18 meters. So generally, it's every 5 to 10 seconds. And if you calculate over a 24-7 period, well, it's a 24-hour period, you're looking at 700,000 plus blasts that go off in a concentrated area, you know, and that ship will be there for 4 to 5 months, depending on conditions. And we're saying, look, that's just what you're not considering is a cumulative effect, and your PR is hiding behind the single thing. So, you know, so they're comparing it to the noise of a ship or the noise of a whale singing. You know, you're not having this constant bombardment, continuous bombardment of sound in that area. And our concern is twofold. You know, the first thing is that its impact is on the ecosystem. It's a sound environment. It's not a light environment like land. So all the creatures in the sea are adapted or evolved in terms of sound. So what happens to them? Now the larger animals supposedly are driven off in where they Shell talks about an exclusion zone. So they have a boat that goes ahead about 500 meters, and that chases away the dolphins and the seals and the whales. But it doesn't chase away the zooplankton and the stuff, the mollusks on the sea bottom, the entire sort of value chain or food chain within that area. And that's our concern. You know, there's research that says that zooplankton is adversely affected by this. And that's what we know, you know. So we're saying, hey, guys, you know, in terms of the precautionary principle in terms of NEMA, we don't know enough, and that which we get to know more is telling us that this thing is of real concern. You know, so SANBI brought out their biodiversity assessment in 2018. It specifically talks about seismic guns, seismic surveys, and the impact, and that they're very concerned about that. You know, we have legislation that's come about, and I think one of the key things for both the two survey areas that we're talking about, one off the Wild Coast and the other one off the Algoa Basin to Otanequa Basin, is that we've had marine protected areas come into being in that period. You know, and And Shell is saying, okay, but we're not surveying above the marine protected areas, as if they can prevent their sound from traveling sideways or in other directions, you know. And so there's no mitigation for that, you know. And we're saying, you know.
021-446-0567 or on the WhatsApp line at 072-567-1567. If you have any questions or if you are wondering exactly what this operation is going to be looking like in terms of, Shell doing seismic blasting, on our coast and what is the effect on, the wildlife of that particular area. Gary Kukumur, welcome back again, Gary. Gary, chat to us about the effect on the wildlife, or about the marine life in that area. Because as you rightly indicated, this is not above ground where, you know, you can mitigate certain things. But this is on the ocean, and life in the ocean is quite different.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so we're looking at an impact on the entire sort of ecosystem, from microorganisms all the way through to macroorganisms. You know, so the ones that we're most aware of dolphins and whales, you know, and those are the ones that tug at our heartstrings. But they are dependent on microorganisms. So zooplankton, for instance. Gqeberha calls itself the bottlenose dolphin capital of the world. What happens if you have offshore for 5 months, this cacophony, this explosion of sound continuously? If I was a dolphin, I wouldn't hang around for the, it's not a symphony, you know. And it's exactly that concern that we have, is that what will happen to the eardrums of the animals. What will happen to the behavior patterns? What happens to the zooplankton in terms of membranes and other stuff? That kind of impact has to be studied. And unfortunately, this is an area of science that is understudied. But the more studies that are done, the clearer it becomes that noise, and specifically things like these kind of sonic booms, have an adverse impact and a long-term impact. So not just short-term, but long-term too, you know? What's quite clear is that the responsible thing to do would not be to continue with an activity that is now required, that law requires different procedures. The responsible thing to do would be is to hold off and to say, let's understand this impact first, and then to see whether or not those activities are necessary. This is clearly, you know, this is profit drives principle. And the companies here involved are not too concerned about their long-term impact on the environment.
Gary Kukumura chatting to us this morning, Wildlife and Environmental Society, Algoa Bay branch. We've got Jeff on the line. Jeff, good morning and welcome to Cape Talk.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Your question for the panel this morning, please, Jeff.
Well, the question or the statement is about, you know, what they're trying to protect at Transkei on the East Coast and so on. But, you know, this government has got a pretty poor track record of controlling things. And what I'm referring to is that, you know, I was in the industry, the rock lobster, so I know what I'm talking about. I got out in 94 because I knew what was going to happen. And I'll give you figures quickly, 87, 88. The total allowable catch for West Coast rock lobster was 3,700 tons of 89 millimeter. They're now struggling to catch 700 tons of 75, you know, Carapace size. And the amount of jobs, they're talking about, you know, the jobs and the income of people that fish and so on Transkei, what will be lost. But it's very difficult to calculate how many jobs have been lost, because the poachers have got a free reign. And you know, that whatever is in the ocean is there forever if it's well managed. And that is basically the problem. It is a sin that the resource has been destroyed to the extent that it has. And it's all about jobs for fowls and quotas for fowls and so on. And that's what you've got to contend with. Thanks for taking my call.
Jeff, thank you so much for giving us a bit of your insights into the rock lobster industry and the fact that, we don't have a very good track record of managing things. Liz, is that correct?
No, I think it is. And not only that, we come from a history where historically people who have fished the coast for generations have been excluded from the ability to get formal quotas or enter the formal industry and are still being marginalized in the process. So yes, it's correct, but I think that this also raises another issue, is we have species that are endangered, critically endangered, and I mean, some of the fisheries, for example, are closed at certain times. There are spawning areas for commercial fish which are off in that area, but also we put management and conservation measures in place, for example, to try and protect turtles, the leatherback and the loggerhead, and those turtles hatch their eggs, or the babies hatch out on the northern KZN coast. Those youngsters then climb into the sea, get themselves in the Agulhas current, and come down with the Agulhas current and wham, straight into this particular area, which is now going to be the reconnaissance survey. And this is to highlight, so we've got all these conservation measures, they're endangered, we need to save as many as we can. This happens between January, February, March, somewhere around there. And where are we having the survey? Right now in that area between, so that will be exactly when the turtles, the baby turtles are coming through. Well, who gives permission for things like that? So I think, you know, the fact that this permit has been given and claimed to have done an environmental audit and claimed to have put mitigation measures in place, when you look at the detail, we don't believe that it's adequate at all. You will hear them say they've got monitors on the ships which can will look for whales and stop the blast if they see an animal that they feel is in the way. But all of these animals are underneath the water, and at night you can't see if it's a bit misty. So even if we had to say, you know, well, let's put the best environmental mitigation measure, you know, then it'll be fine. They haven't done that. And so there is certainly a feeling, I think, of outrage that it seems that the companies that are involved in this are very dismissive of the kind of environmental issues which affect us all, because it's one planet, one life support system, of which the ocean is a critical part.
Yeah, you know, when they come out and say that we are a responsible operator, we share a deep desire to protect our unique and diverse environment, and, you know, the nice things about taking care to prevent and minimize impact to fish, marine mammals and other wildlife, and the welfare of the wildlife is a major factor in the stringent controls we use. Here's a different concern. We've got a voice note in from someone saying, my main concern is when they find it, well...
With regards to Shell and their research that they're doing, my other concern is not only the research that they're doing, but if they do happen to find oil and they start putting up all these horrible rigs all over the place that have an extremely vulnerable and difficult sea condition, area, an area that has incredibly high seas, rough seas, and if something goes wrong, the oil slicks that could potentially happen in the future could be an absolute disaster. So I really think that this is an absolute disgusting from our government point of view that they allow anything like this, and like your guest says, especially when we have wind and sun that we could be researching, and what we don't need to research, we know that the wind and sun could help in the long run, without a doubt. My view from Nick in Cape Town.
And Nick has got a valid point, and he's got reason to be concerned, eh, Gary? Because it's not only a question of the environment or the very, very difficult and very complex ecosystem that is below the ocean floor, or, you know, below the ocean that we need to take care of, with the actual sort of now that they are busy, you know, seeking to do the seismic testing. But what if they do find oil? What happens then?
Yeah.
Yeah, Absolutely, you know, and it's a thin edge of a wedge. It's the start of a very long process, you know, and so they do the seismic surveys, then they come and do test boreholes, and then eventually they'll exploit the thing, and then there's a whole lot of stuff that happens in between. You know, and one of the points that they make is that this is supposedly drives jobs. You know, if you look at the seismic blasting itself, it's all experts on board, and they travel the world. There's very few local jobs that come through this. And throughout that entire value chain, it's mainly specialists that have to be appointed and supervised and trained internally in that. So you can't, every time you land in port, hire a bunch of new people. You can hire someone to wash down your decks or to remove the rubbish, but you can't do the specialist jobs. You know, so the real question for us, you know, and we come from two principles. The one is sustainable development, and the other one is collective stewardship. In terms of sustainable development, what is the sustainability of this industry? Is it required? It's not required. We know that. We know now in the 60s and 70s, possibly you could have made that argument, but you can't make that argument successfully anymore. We have enough natural resources in South Africa to supply an overabundance. The CSIR have studied it. They've gone through the reports. You know, so the data is there to say that there are alternatives. If there weren't an alternative, then maybe there's an argument to be made. But, you know, I mean, it's not just the potential oil pollution. One of the biggest issues in the marine world is noise pollution. You know, and if you just go on to any of those marine trackers and you see how many ships are actually in circulation around the globe at the moment, and you think that if you're a creature in that space and you have that continual noise, that's an issue. Now on top of this, we're going to have 5 months of bombardment, and it's bombardment, you know, 700,000 shots a day. Where do these sea creatures go? What happens to them? And so for us, the second thing is, in terms of collective stewardship, is that we're saying that we as humans impact the earth, but we have the chance to manage our impact and to do things. It's not to say that we must shut down industry, but it is to say that we must find better ways of doing the things that we do. There are better ways available. Shell, as a responsible corporate citizen, should be considering that, and they should be holding back on stuff where we don't actually understand the impact of their things. And if you damage that ecosystem, how long does it take to restore it? Can it be restored? And we don't think so. We think that we have an asset in hand, and that asset should be protected.
Gary Kukumura chatting to us from Klabega, and of course Liz McDade in Cape Town, founder and strategic lead at the Green Connection, and unpacking for us exactly what the impact of the seismic blasting will be on the ocean floor just off the Eastern Cape.